you for coming out. What I'm going to present to you today is part of a broader set of projects that I've been working on for some time now. The first is this project on health and social justice, which is culminating in a book that I just published, which I brought to show you, and I have flyers of the book. I'm only going to briefly spend one slide basically going over the gist of the book, you can look at it at your leisure if you're interested in the book. But I'm going to focus specifically on talking about the main concept, an organizing concept or focal variable that's a part of the health and social justice framework, which is this idea of health capability, which is part of the general framework of human flourishing. A second project I just want to mention, I'm not going to talk about today, that is sort of the follow-on to this project, is a project that I'm calling Global Health Justice and Governance. And that's basically taking the same framework of human flourishing and Aristotelian roots applying it at the global scale, looking at allocation of moral responsibility for health, global health externalities, and inequalities, and issues of governance at the global level. So that's another project that I'm working on. So just by way of outline, in terms of my talk today, I'm going to just spend one slide talking about the broader theoretical framework for health and social justice that I've presented in the book. Talk about approaches to ethics and economics in health. The health and social justice framework is very much interdisciplinary, drawing in concepts from ethics and economics and also politics and political science. I'll talk less about that today. Talk about the contrast between what I call the health capability paradigm, which is what I develop in the book, and other approaches. And then I'm going to focus on this conceptual model of health capability, this idea of health capability, and then focus on the two primary dimensions of that idea, which are health agency and health functioning. I'll then present this idea of a health capability profile. I'm actually looking at operationalizing the concept of health capability through this profile, I'm actually in some early stages of survey development. And then discuss very, very briefly applications and assessments. So in terms of the theoretical framework of health and social justice that I've developed in the book, I've basically divided the book into two parts. There's a theoretical part and there's an applications part. In the theoretical part, I focus at the onset of justifying social justice in terms of health from the basis or foundation of human flourishing. This very much has Aristotelian roots. From human flourishing, or what we call human capabilities, or the capability theory or capability approach, I derive this concept of health capability, which is really what I'm going to talk about today. A second component of the theoretical part of the book is applying theory from social choice and public choice to a derivation of a capability set, in particular a health capability set. The third aspect is an idea of transpositionality and understanding of prioritization in terms of this concept of health capability, and understanding the particular viewpoints on which we would go about defining or conceptualizing health capability. I then get into issues of inequality and conceptualizing inequality and measuring inequality as applied to the focal variable health capability, and promote in particular, argue for a particular concept called shortfall inequality, which actually has roots in welfare economic research. I then focus on ethical commitments and public moral norms, and I have a whole section on the ethics of the social determinants of health. A lot of you doing work in this area know that that's that has been a fairly hot area in ethics. And then I have a perspective on resource allocation, which combines scientific and deliberative principles, and then I talk about this framework called shared health governance. So that's in the first part of the book. It's quite thick. And then I apply this framework to several policy areas. The first is equal access, and here I bring in this concept of health agency that I'm going to be talking about today. And I emphasize the importance of norms in thinking about equal access. I address specifically the issue of responsibility in health, and particularly discuss the application of this framework to these sort of behavioral economic and newer concepts of libertarian paternalism and paternalism, and autonomy limiting policies. I then have a section on health insurance and the idea of risk and how this framework deals with preventing, mitigating, and coping with risk. I then grapple with the issue of opportunity costs and argue for it being a major part of a conceptualization about health and social justice. And then the last part of the book really is about the policymaking process and applying the framework in terms of agreement around different principles and norms for health policy legislation. So that's the book in a nutshell. Okay, good. So I'm going to talk now about this concept of health capability and the health capability paradigm. So first what I do, both in the book and then I have some other articles that I've written. I actually have a paper I just published in the American Journal of Public Health on this idea of health capability. And I contrast the health capability paradigm with other paradigms or other perspectives in ethics and economics, starting with the free market and consumer rationality and choosing healthcare based on willingness to pay, fair processes, and sort of a Daniels-esque and Daniels and Sabin orientation towards setting up fair processes for justifying allocating resources, and that based on also a fair equality of opportunity account. I contrast it with utilitarianism, and I'm going to talk specifically about these different foci in just a minute. Contrast it with a more resource-oriented or equal distribution of goods or resources perspective. I contrast it with some of the extra welfareism and that work around maximizing health or taking health as a variable, but still very much from a utilitarian or economic framework. There's work that's being done on well-being and quality of life. I'm thinking in particular here of the Powers of Faden book on justice and medicine. There's libertarian arguments for emphasizing autonomy and restricting any type of intervention or restriction of autonomy. And then contrast it with a much more narrow focus typically in bioethics on autonomy, in particular in these issues of end-of-life care, right to refuse care, physician-assisted suicide, voluntary and informed consent. That's really not where the focus of the book is. The book is really, and my work is generally more on the policy level. So in contrasting the health capability paradigm with these other different perspectives, I particularly emphasize the focus of a lot of these other perspectives in their emphasis on material and financial resources and on particular distribution of particular goods, as opposed to, as you'll see as I go through the health capability idea, a distribution of conditions in which and skills and agency enhancing environments in which people can promote their own health. That basically make the argument that none of these different perspectives capture a fundamental reality in the health ethics realm, which is that people seek both good health and the ability to pursue it. And I'll talk more about what that means. And so it's difficult for these different perspectives to simultaneously address both consequentialist foci on outcomes and then proceduralist foci on processes and procedures for establishing fairness. So here are some of the alternative informational bases of justice that I discuss in the book and then also in some of the other work that I've done. I'm basically contrasting what I'm putting up there, which is capability and human flourishing, with these perspectives. So utilitarianism takes utilities or preferences for certain things or goods or health states as the privileged variable, and maximizing social utility is the goal and the emphasis. Standard economic analysis looks at general income or willingness to pay, willingness to accept these types of, or the free market and trading in the free market as the standard. Rawlsian perspectives focus more on primary goods and providing people with their shares of resources. Libertarianism focuses on procedures and negative rights, that providing health care, for example, from a public policy perspective would violate taxpayers' rights. So that would not be acceptable from that framework. Communitarianism privileges community values and expresses a commitment to shared community values. And then finally, I put forth this idea of capabilities and effective freedom that is really about enhancing people's ability to function and ability to achieve functioning. So that's where I'm going is fleshing that out a little bit more. Here's just a little mathematical schema to try to articulate why it's important to examine, critically assess the focal space or the focal variable that one is using to evaluate justice. And this is just basically a comparison of two frames in the first horizontal case, primary goods and a commodity space versus a health capability space, and then the lower pane, a utility space versus a health capability space. And I haven't put any particular numbers on these on this graph, but the idea is just to demonstrate that somebody could have a certain utility for a health state, for example, and a utilitarian would look at that utility for a health state. In fact, we do that. I actually have done that type of research, assessing qualities, or there are all sorts of types of utility assessment. But that same person could look very different in terms of their ability to be healthy. And so translating between those two spaces can give us very different results. The same thing with having a bundle of goods. Somebody could have, or two people could have, very similar bundles of goods, but look very different in terms of their ability to be healthy. So in terms of more information about the contrast between the health capability paradigm and other approaches, basically a health capability paradigm or approach focuses more on ensuring conditions for people to be healthy, not necessarily ensuring equal welfare, equal utilities, equal happiness, equal resources, or equal opportunities. So it's a completely different frame of reference. Unlike a libertarian approach, the health capability paradigm would not support individuals opting out of social obligations or special obligations and responsibilities to help pay for those obligations. I'm not going to go into responsibility again. I identified it as one of the parts I do talk about in the book, but it's very much a part of the framework. Health capability has a wider focus than just health related factors like disease diagnosis and epidemiology, and I'll talk about that. You'll see how that framework fits within a health capability idea. So rather, health capability is more focused on understanding how individuals navigate the health system and their environment to access care, and also understanding the constraints that individuals face in their ability to be healthy. So health capability and the health capability paradigm is designed to, or is focusing on, illuminating the barriers and the enhancers for people's individual health capability. So what they can actually do, what they can actually be in an optimal environment, so if they're doing well in terms of their abilities, versus where they may be at a certain stage in terms of their health achievement. So it has very much a potential, the difference between actual and potential health achievement idea behind it. So trying to understand the gap between where people are and where people could be is a setup for the framework. And so the paradigm values both health outcomes, and so the consequentialists focus on that, and also health agency, which is how people get to those outcomes. I'll talk about that again shortly. So let me just start, take us back to capability theory, which is the organizing framework for the health capability paradigm. And I attribute this to Marcia Sen. Martha Nussbaum's also done a lot of work in this area, and both sort of schools of work have roots in Aristotle's idea of human flourishing. But I'm taking in particularly the Sen perspective again. But Nussbaum has done some really terrific work in this area. So Sen defines capability in four parts. The first is well-being freedom. And this is the freedom to achieve individual states of well-being. The second is well-being achievement, which is the actual achievement of individual states of well-being. The third is agency freedom, which is the freedom to achieve what one values and wishes to achieve and what one pursues. And the fourth is agency achievement, which is achieving one's goals and objectives. So this is the four-part framework for how I'm going to take this development of this idea of health capability and move it forward. So in conceptualizing health capability, here's how I'm thinking about it, which is that health capability is the ability to be healthy. It's not just health. It's the ability to be healthy. It includes constructs of health or health functioning, how you're actually doing it health-wise, but also health agency, and I'll define health agency shortly, and that those two dimensions or structures provide the organizing and guiding principles for further defining this concept of health capability. It's a lifelong set of abilities. It has a very dynamic quality, or so I'm arguing, and it has a changing quality, and it has an ability to adapt to different circumstances and contexts and changes over time. It's different from capacity. I emphasize this. I emphasize this in the recent article that I published, because earlier, so I've been working on this working capability theory for a long time. And earlier, people would say, "Well, how is it different from capacity? What is capability versus capacity?" And I really take a very literal distinction here. That capacity actually has volume or quantity implications. And I'm quoting here from the dictionary, capacity is the ability to receive or contain, whereas capability has a more active and less restrictive operationalization, that is the ability to perform with potential for achieving a desired end. It entails the capability of converting something or turning something from one state to another, or from one thing to another. So in continuing with the conceptual model of health capability, health capability is not just a set of individual skills, although that is definitely a part of it. And you'll see when I present the profile, that's certainly something that I'm trying to capture and understand better. But it's also a set of situations and conditions that enable optimal health. It requires assessment of societal level factors on which health capabilities depend. So the external environment enhances or detracts from our health capability, from our health functioning, and also from our health agency. It includes theoretical constructs at the individual and the societal level. And you'll see what I mean about that in a minute. It involves socially dependent definitions of capabilities, which differ from a multi-level analytical framework in which factors are seen as causally related to or linearly related to particular health conditions. The socially dependent capabilities directly incorporate at the individual level the extent to which a macro or even a meso level variable may be influencing someone's ability to be healthy. And so the idea here is to try to capture in a more precise way the heterogeneity that occurs when people interact with their environment, whether in a, I'll show you a conceptualization, actually a schema of that in a minute, and do that in very different ways. Really, I'm suggesting, or I argue, literally at the individual level. Heterogeneity is real, not even in social categories now, black, white, you know, race, income, education, there's a lot of blending and mixing, and so trying to get an understanding at the individual level, I think, has a lot of going power. So trying to understand and measure the impact of irreducibly social goods on individual circumstances is important, rather than assuming the goodness or badness of a social factor. It's bad to be poor, it's good to be rich, it's bad to be in this income category, that income category, this education category, that education category, live in this neighborhood, live in that neighborhood, live in an apartment, live in a house. I mean, there are judgments that are made about those categories separately from understanding the goodness or badness of them for every individual person. And so that's in their ability to be healthy. So that's the idea here. And so the individual is the unit of analysis, even though it takes into consideration social factors. That's the setup. So here's sort of the conceptual model of it, with health capability at the intersection here. And that health capability is basically the confidence and ability to be effective in achieving optimal health, given biologic and genetic predisposition, and intermediate and broader social, economic, and political factors, and also access to public health and healthcare systems and services. But that particular idea is encompassing sets of influences from these different areas. So the first is obviously biological and genetic predisposition. So everybody comes into the world with a certain genetic makeup, and there is variation in that, and there is biology and personality and predisposition to risk, etc. And those are part of our makeup, make us different. There's the intermediate social context. There's the public health and healthcare system, and then there's the macro and social and political environment. So another question that has been asked when I've talked about this before is, how does this differ, this idea of health capability? You think of capability, you think of potential, and I just described that potential is absolutely a part of the framework of the setup. But it's not just human endowment or natural endowment. Health capability is about the way in which not only your individual endowment or biological predisposition predisposes you to something in terms of your health, but also how you interact with the environment, and whether it be very macro or meso level in terms of your ability to be healthy. So it's not just human endowment. You aren't just born with the potential. The potential changes over time depending on the context and the influence of these external factors. So that's a significant difference. It's also much more longitudinal, intersectorial in its presentation. And again, as I talked about, it allows for more heterogeneity. And it also tries to understand the lost information that evolves from assuming the goodness and badness of particular categories of socioeconomic status, for example, on individuals by trying to understand at the individual level how those factors are inhibiting or enhancing people's ability to be healthy. So it incorporates external factors into the individual level in terms of the assessment. So that means there's the measurement is done at the individual level. It also differs from more causal models in terms of the multiple relationships and factors that influence people. The overlapping idea is much more nuanced, sequentially iterative, and creates more of a multidimensional understanding than is typically allowable, even in sort of structural equations and sort of hierarchical modeling and other types of approaches to looking at how these factors influence people at the individual level. So let me come back to the sort of two dimensions of health capability that I've identified or defined. And so one is health functioning or health, that health is important, it's the consequentialist, it's absolutely the outcome, the consequences matter, and the other is health agency. I'll talk now about each of these. So health or health functioning is the outcome. It's the outcome of the action to maintain or improve health. We'll talk in a minute about how to measure that. It's comprehensive. Here's where in the book I talk about the transpositionality and the idea that the need to measure or conceptualize or define health from multiple different perspectives. There's a lot of sociology of illness and a lot of different literature on this that's really terrific. But I do draw on this idea of transpositionality, which is to the extent that we can have a view from everywhere about what health is or what health might be, that would be beneficial so that we can standardize across and allow assessments across different groups of people, different countries, different subgroups within countries, etc. And so in the book I settle on a particular definition of health that's fairly comprehensive. It's not as comprehensive as the WHO definition, but it includes mental and physical functioning and it's a fairly robust measure. But it's not well-being or quality of life. That's not what I'm trying to get at here when I'm talking about health or health functioning. That's much broader. There are people who are promoting that in the area of social justice related to health. Again, I think of the Powers and Faden book, and I'm trying to be much more restrictive in terms of health. Health agency is a particular and very narrow type of agency. Now, agency is a term that's been used a lot over many years. And here, taking the SEN capability theory definition, I use the agency freedom and agency achievement parts to the theory, but I'm applying it to a very particular dimension of well-being, and that's health. And so in this domain, I call this health agency. Now, broader influences of agency can affect health agency and even other domain-specific types of agency, like educational agency, can affect health agency. But I'm specifically, again, I'm being pretty narrow here, even though it seems like a very broad framework, I'm being actually pretty narrow in this this conceptualization of what I've been calling health agency. So I've defined health agency as the an individual's ability to achieve health goals that they value and to act as agents of their own health. More specifically, health agency is the ability to acquire and draw on health-related information, knowledge, and skills to preserve health and develop habits and conditions to prevent the onset of morbidity and mortality. So we need to identify how well individuals can act as an agent of their own health in order to understand more about how well they're doing in terms of their health capability. So a health capability profile, which is where I'm going with this operationalization of this concept, is really trying to create a framework for health capability. At this point, I'm going to talk about the different dimensions of it that I've mapped out, and this really very much follows this article that I recently published, and that I haven't really set up a weighting scheme or any type of a way of combining these different domains into a single summary measure or index, you know, a health capability index, for example. I could go there if I end up awaiting these different domains, but I'm not there at this stage. And also, as you'll see, a profile, I think a health capability profile actually provides more information for people in terms of where how they're doing on each of these different subdomains. So I think that this can help, a profile can help people select different concepts and domains that for a health capability classification that may be relevant for them in terms of what use they want to have for this. And then different applications will require different types of measures. Okay, so I've defined this health capability as having two sort of aspects to it, or two pillars, I guess. One is internal factors, internal to a person, to an individual, and the second is external factors. So internal factors that I think are relevant for health functioning and health agency are, and for understanding, is first understanding where people are in terms of their health status and their health functioning. And I'll talk about some specific measures of that very, very briefly. Health knowledge and information. Here, getting into things like health literacy. Health seeking skills and beliefs and notions of self-efficacy. Here's the, and I actually have a pilot study that I, a pilot survey that I'm working on now, and I've built on some of the work of Bandura and folks who've done some great stuff on self-efficacy. Health values and goals. This is highly relevant because part of health agency, or the way that I've defined it, is a person being able to be an agent of their own health in terms of achieving health goals that they value. So this is important to understand what goals that they value. Now, there is a normative foundation here, which is that I want to assess where people are in terms of their health values and goals, but I ultimately want to move people to a more positive valuation of health or assessment of health. So I've presented this before, and people said, well, you know, what do you want to do with health agency? You want to help, you know, the drug addict be a better drug addict, or, you know, a heroin addict be more, a better heroin addict, or you know, somebody who doesn't value health very highly to pursue health goals that may be damaging to them. And so there is a normative component here that good health values, or valuing health highly, or positive values of health, is part of the optimal health capability state. So I want to make that explicit, because I do think that is part of the health agency concept, that it could very much be construed as helping people achieve health goals that are not very, very favorable to their health. The other part of this set of internal factors I think is relevant is self-governance and self-management, and perceived self-governance and self-management. And this is really, I'll talk a little bit more about this. This is really an interesting idea of trying to think about vision for how people design their plans for their own health and being agents of their own health. Effective health decision making, intrinsic motivation to achieve desirable health outcomes, and then positive expectations about achieving health outcomes. So these are sort of the different components of the internal factors that I think are relevant for thinking about health functioning and health agency. Externally, and this is where I part again with those first several sets of other approaches to ethics and economics. I first and foremost start on trying to assess and understand social norms and how social norms are affecting people's ability to be healthy, and literally asking people about that. Social networks and social capital for achieving positive health outcomes, This gets into some of the social capital literature that's been very helpful in thinking about health and specific group membership and influences, material circumstances. They certainly do count, but they're really not, shouldn't be the main focus of resource allocation, or so I suggest. People's sense of security in terms of their economic and political environment, the utilization and access to health services, and the extent to which the public health and healthcare systems are enabling or not. Okay, so I'm going to go through each of these very quickly. I have about 13 minutes left, so I'm going to go through these extremely quickly. But this gives you some idea. So I'm going. I've got this pilot survey that's a general survey, and then I have four disease-specific surveys that I'm working on, and in the area of AIDS, in the area of substance abuse, in the area of nutrition and obesity. And these are the they're derived from this sort of general framework and general set of pool of ideas about questions. So in here's just in terms of health status and health functioning, the types of things I'm talking about are in many ways, in some cases I've made up questions, in some cases I've used questions that already exist in the literature, like the SF-36, which I think is an actually incredibly useful way to assess health functioning. And then just measures of health conditions, including objective and subjective. So that's health and health functioning. Health knowledge is, these are questions about people's knowledge of their own health, and their health conditions, their general knowledge of health and disease, their knowledge of the costs and benefits of health behaviors, lifestyles, and exposures, and their knowledge of how to acquire health information and knowledge, and you know, ways of modes of obtaining that information. Here I'm trying to get at the research question of why health literacy efforts have actually been fairly unsuccessful in many ways, by couching, I think, this idea of health knowledge and the ability to use information and make trade-offs and understand decision-making is actually trying to, it puts knowledge and information in a more, in my view, a more effective framework. Okay, health-seeking skills and beliefs, self-efficacy, like I said, there's some really great literature already about that. I've built on that. I've added some of my own questions. But these are things like beliefs about one's ability to achieve health outcomes, and under different circumstances, in particular, the ability to acquire skills and confidence, and people's ability to perform or abstain from different behaviors. Then I have this whole section on health values and goals, and this is where I'm explicitly stating that I think in the optimal health capability state, this is going to have a positive health value. So assessing people's value of health, their value of health-related goals, the value of lifestyle choices and behaviors, and then their ability to recognize and counter damaging social norms and the extent to which that matches with their own values of health. This is an area I'm just really interested in, these ideas of self-governance and self-management. Which I actually think are very different. I'm thinking of them in very different ways. That self-governance is more about vision, and I do work in addiction, and one of the things that people say about people who are chronically addicted is that it's seen in many ways as a career. That's the first thing people think about when they get up in the morning. It's the last thing they think about when they go to bed. They think about it in a weekly and a monthly fashion in terms of how to get things and what to do. And that this idea of planning and vision and thinking about health is actually important to achieving good health. People's ability to manage personal and professional situations, the ability to make connection between cause and effect, with regard to personal behavior and health outcomes, the ability to draw on networks of social groups. So this is not just the access to social groups. It's not just if you belong to a church. It's not just if you're part of a community. It's not just if you have a neighborhood, it's whether or not you're actually drawing on those resources to improve your health that matters. And then again, this idea of vision and direction, planning and strategy, and ability to make positive health choices, that these skills are in a evolving and changing environment for every individual over time is something that's important to embed. Effective health decision making, again, using health knowledge and resources, weighing short-term and long-term costs and benefits, identifying health problems, and the ability to make healthy choices even under difficult circumstances. Intrinsic motivation, this is another area that I'm really interested in, this difference between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. I think it's partly because coming from a health economics background, a lot of interest has developed in incentivizing people extrinsically with all sorts of different motivations and financial or otherwise. And you know, the research that I think is out there at this stage is suggesting that those types of incentives work for a short period, but they don't maintain the effect over the long term. Again, there's a lot of work in addiction on this, that you gain really good short-term effects of people being clean or abstaining for a short period, but then after the incentive goes away, their external incentive, the people go back to the behavior. And so the extent to which intrinsic motivation is there versus extrinsic, I think is important. Okay. Then now to the external factors. Just quickly, some of the things that I've been looking at, social norms. This, I think, is very, very important. The extent to which norms are scientifically valid and evidence-based. And this is not insignificant, even in this country, to know that. We have a lot of evidence that norms about health that are not evidence-based can be very damaging, and people have differential access to that. To the extent that they are influenced by that is important to understand and to react to. The extent to which in their environment health behaviors and health-seeking skills are actually seen favorably or not. They may be in an environment where poor health habits are actually seen as a positive thing in terms of overall behavior. So this is something that is important. The extent to which behavior is adopted by a majority or a minority of the population. And by whom? Is it particular leaders? Is it people look up to? Thinking here in a village where the leaders may be adopting a particular behavior, even though it's just one or two people, it could be very influential. Norms about decisional latitude in terms of power. So in many, for example, developing country contexts, so research that I'm doing, this is one of the most essential factors is whether or not a woman has access to resources, but also whether she has the power to make the decision to gain those resources for herself, for her children, or even for her spouse. So this decisional latitude and the inhibition there is quite important. Okay, social networks and social capital. I talked a little bit about that already. I only have about 4 minutes, so I'm going to run through these very quickly. Standard issues and maternal material circumstances. And again, these are standard measures that I'm using already from the literature in this survey. The questions on the utilization and access to health services focus very specifically here, I think, with the disease-specific measures. I'm having some good luck with trying to actually contextualize whether or not people are actually recognizing a symptom of a poor health condition, whether or not they're able to understand that they have a need, the perception of the need, the ability to then obtain the services, and then whether or not they're barriers. So the whole continuum from the onset of a symptom to whether or not people have access. So trying to sort of, again, fill the information gap that sort of exists often when we're trying to see, well, wait a minute, that person has Medicaid, or that person has dental insurance, or there's a dentist's office there right in their neighborhood that they had, that they're covered for under Medicaid. You know, why aren't that, you know, just trying to understand the sort of, you know, start to finish and understand where the barriers are in terms of that person, turning that resource that they may have entitlement to or equal access to in terms of whether they're able to use that to produce a better health outcome. So that's the idea there. And then this idea of trying to understand also, even when people interact with the healthcare system, whether it's enhancing their health agency, specifically their health agency, or not. And what's left at the door in terms of providing information or referring somebody or giving some medication or whatever. Are people really sort of taking, is the health system taking them from the point of when they have a need to when they actually can fulfill that need? Okay, so I just have 2 minutes and I have just a couple slides left. So basically this is early in this sort of operationalization of this idea. I'm developing surveys. If they're individual based, I'm pilot testing some batteries of questions, and I'm currently looking at some psychometric properties in terms of these pilot questions, reliability and validity. And I'm just trying to understand these dimensions and how people react to the questions, and understanding also whether or not they're mapping, they correlate with each other, and they also, if there's an underlying construct of health agency and health functioning in these questions as well. So I think this is actually something that can be applied fairly widely even on an individual basis. I think there's a lot of technology out there with computers and handheld devices, and even in the most remote areas, there are ways that we can gather information, and I'm hoping that this is something that I can use to assess individuals on these different dimensions, and even in the most difficult circumstances. And then use that information to evaluate their interaction or their access to particular interventions or policies or in particular the healthcare system. So I think also in trying to, I'll finish in just 1 minute here. I think in a broader sense, trying to link the information that may be gained from gathering this, piloting these surveys, and then getting information from individuals, hoping on the provider side to link that up with people who are actually in decision-making positions, so that they can look at the information, understand where these gaps may be and where people are failing to convert resources, for example, into health outcomes. And so I'm hoping that the use of tying that from the individual level to the provider level actually helps in maybe even refining some of the interventions and policies and systems that we have. And I think I'll just stop right there. Thanks.
So we have time for questions.
Good. Yes.
I have a question about how would you see this paradigm applying to diseases or conditions where we're talking about multiple systems that affect it. I'm specifically interested in mental health, mental health care. So you're talking not only just the healthcare system and those policies, but also the social welfare system, the judicial system, and its involvement with crime. Have you envisioned an application of the paradigm in those cases where you're touching these multiple systems at the same time?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and that's why I was starting to say that I'm having better luck with the disease-specific measures, and that's sort of where I'm finding is that, you know, a general measure is wonderful because it's across it sort of can give a snapshot of where people are, you know, in terms of their health capability. But the disease-specific measures really can bring together those different systems and those different focal points around a particular condition. And I think you can capture more from the survey when we're looking at a specific condition. So yeah, I think that's that. And what I'm finding in these pilot surveys is just really more in the reaction to it is that I can actually then figure out better, which is what I'm trying to do, where the breakdown is and where the points of barriers and potential, either at the individual side to make them recognize where things are failing, and then again, hopefully delivering that back to the provider side as well.
Obviously, I'm really intrigued by the measurement challenges and all of this as a survey researcher. But one, I guess I have 2 points. One is, how do you conceptualize the measurement of the value of health? That was an important point that you made, that everyone might have attribute different levels of value to health. Are you measuring it vis-a-vis other goods, other things in life, education, family, friends, etc.? Are you trying to measure health in and of itself? And the second question I have, it seems in your model there's a strong element of a time horizon. There's sort of the predictive future prospective aspect of capability that we differentiate it from capacity, which seemed more like a measurement at the current time, if that makes sense. So I'm wondering in the survey work, if you have envisioned a longitudinal to see how things not only hang together now, but can predict, can predict relationships among the different domains.
So let me answer the second question first. So that I do envision it longitudinally, that we sort of take a snapshot, like a panel survey, basically, follow people over time. But the idea would be that you're trying to actually capture where they are at that particular time, though, not ask them so many questions about the future, because the idea is that they're actually their circumstances are changing. Presumably, they'll be changing. And so trying to figure out how they actually reacted in this particular situation versus the next year or whatever is actually the type of information that I think would be useful in understanding how people are able to be healthy in these different contexts. And hopefully there's an improvement. That's the idea of using the information back. So definitely a longitudinal, but the time horizon really is, at the survey, it's the point in time. The time horizon for the person in understanding how they evolve in terms of their health capability is over time, if that makes sense. The value of health, I'm absolutely trying to definitely get away from health economic approaches to valuing health, which typically try to put some sort of a monetary value on health. So hedonic measures, or looking at, you know, sort of backing into it in some way, asking people their willingness to pay or willingness to accept for a particular health condition. You know, if they eat a sandwich that has it has been sitting out for 2 days versus, I mean, you know, there's lots of ways to do that and try to get an exact value on health. I think that there's, and even juries, you know, would they have information now from juries that, you know, try to put values on health. And I think that all those are problematic. So what I'm trying to do is trying to get a sense of people's value of positive health states, basically. And so it's more of a continuum from their value of a poor health state to their value of a positive or optimal health state. So the idea here is getting an optimal health, but I'm not doing it in a preference elicitation type of manner. I'm not trying to get a utility on it. I'm not trying to get a strength of their trade-off with other goods or other health states. I'm just trying to understand how, in general, people value being in optimal health or good health. Because that actually, I think, even in a disease-specific measure, how much people value being in optimal health. First of all, identifying what optimal health is. And then understanding whether people really do value that, because not everybody does. I mean, you know, people don't identify it, and then they don't value it very highly. And so again, I'm putting a normative thrust on this, suggesting that, you know, valuing optimal health is better and is good and will help you have better, not just health, but health agency as well. Because if you're going for a good goal or a positive goal, then that's part of the whole equation. It's not just getting to the goal, it's actually having the good goal to start with. That's the idea there. Yes?
Increasingly, certainly in our society, there are a lot of adults who do not, it's really, you're focusing on the individual, but there are a lot of adults with chronic illnesses who may be, have partial capacity to be involved in decision making and making their own choices.
Yes.
There are children with a lot of chronic illnesses. So there's often a family, sort of a combined family or group effort to assess some of these issues, as, you know, not just always focusing on the individuals and sort of structure and beliefs. And I'm just wondering if there's any way to measure that, because I'm thinking of a lot of, you know, elderly perhaps who have a lot of family caregivers who are very much involved in, you know, have their own viewpoints and values, and that sort of merges and interfaces with the patients. How does that, how can you assess as a family unit or a caregiving unit as opposed to the individual?
Yes, system? No, it's an excellent question. I would say that for better or for worse, I'm funneling it through the individual. Okay, so to the extent that those resources, those people, those groups are helping the person, again, meet the goals that they value, then their health capability is enhanced. That individual's health capability is enhanced. I'm not saying there's a health capability of that whole group. I am incorporating exactly what you said, but really from the individual, funneling it through the individual. Again, for better or for worse, it could, you know, I think one criticism of that would be that, you know, in some society, I think of Asian societies, I've, you know, read a lot of literature on sociology of illness and everything, that's actually not an individual level capability. That is a family capability. The family decides, sometimes they don't even tell the individual, you know, what they have or what the treatment options are and what the way forward is, that's actually the family that does that. So I wouldn't be incorporating that as well in this individualized framework. I could modify it by that and say that that's a proxy for that individual, and that would be one way of doing. But I'm definitely am sort of funneling it through the individual. Yes.
I'm wondering about the concept or the idea that there is a plurality of health values, and wondering what that plurality is, as opposed to the question of how much do I value the one value, good health.
Yeah.
So I can see that there could be different ways of me hierarchizing how much I value good health.
Yes.
But I'm struggling with what it means to have a plurality of health values. And your example was about folks who might be addicted to heroin or thinking about trying to help them achieve a better heroin addiction status or something, and that seemed to ring hollow to me, that that one would value being an addict. And I'm not saying, what I mean by that is, just because I don't live up to a value of, mm-hmm. of optimal health doesn't mm-hmm. mean I don't possess the value mm-hmm. of optimal health.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I eat a Big Mac, mm-hmm. I chastise myself
yeah.
for it.
I
don't want to eat it, but I do. And so bringing in a Platonic concept, akrasia, rather than Aristotelian, of weakness of the will, and I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, because I try to do my best, but yet, many, many times I fail to live up to what I hold as the value.
Mm-hmm.
So, but by the fact that I don't exercise 3 times a week and I eat more Big Macs than I should, you shouldn't infer that I don't value
right.
my health.
Right, right. No, it does, those are excellent points, and that's the whole idea of having a more comprehensive survey that includes that as an information point, because that's exactly what we want to know, is if you have that value and you want to get there, but the breakdown is in will or these other, or maybe there's other, maybe there are no gyms near you, or maybe there's, you know, maybe you don't have time, maybe there are other factors, then that's actually the decision point or the focal point, rather than the fact that you just aren't valuing being more physically active or healthier.
Is there a true plurality of health values? I mean, I'm a moral philosopher, so I like the whole idea of plurality of values, but
mm-hmm.
I think that there are some values that it's hard to be human and not have. like to want to exist, even when you don't want to exist, because you're in so much pain that it's blocked out the fact that you actually wanted to exist. So are there really people who say, I love being in bad health?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's interesting because I went to a talk at the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, where this particular issue came up, that, you know, there's a big, in the health ethics and economics literature, there's a debate about whether it's well-being and quality of life and health is one value as part of that. And people who don't value health as much as maybe something else in that set should, you know, be allowed to trade off those values. I mean, that's very much a health economic perspective that's fine and that's okay. And I'm not saying it's not okay. I'm saying let's understand actually what people's value of health is to the extent that we want to enhance their ability to achieve a positive health goal.
I think I'll just do one follow-up to make sure that I'm getting this confusion out. I understand the idea that I might hierarchize good health lower than some other value like monetary success. So I understand that I'm giving myself an answer because I want to be wealthy teaching classes in bioethics. So I just run myself to the ground and therefore I have an ulcer. So I've hierarchized money.
So health versus other,
that's different than my having a, in that set of things that I'm hierarchizing, you've got good health in your set, but you value it less than making a lot of money. In my set, I've got bad health, that's what I like, and I hierarchize it in a certain way. Like, to me, the value is good health, but the question is, where do I prioritize it? But sometimes when you're using the phrase, it sounds like you're talking that there is a plurality of values about health.
There's a lot of variation about how people value their health.
That's a good question about how they value it, as opposed, because that means
they have different values of health. There's a lot of, I think, empirical evidence that suggests that there's a plurality of values about health.
What would one be? Just give me an example, then I'll be able to go away.
Well, I gave you the example of the addict or whatever, is that they actually, you know, say that the value of their health in terms of being, they know they're in bad health. They know they don't want that's something that they actually are willing to accept, you know, with their addiction. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you identify that and understand that, and explicitly recognize that valuation, maybe there's an opportunity to, it's like goal setting, maybe there's an opportunity to change the actions towards that goal if you identify the goal and recognize, you know, what people are actually doing to achieve that goal.
Would an example be that they say that hard work may pay off in the future, but laziness pays off right now? Hypertension is a disease that actually has no symptoms, you feel fine, and they give you a pill to make you healthier that makes you feel bad. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who decide not to take their antihypertensives because they don't want to feel bad, even knowing that they're willing to accept an increased risk of stroke or heart failure down the road.
That's right. That's another one. And then, you know, I mean, smoking is another very good example. Again, it's within the addiction literature that I know, but, I think there's an overarching question of addiction and whether it's controlling your assessment of your own value of health or not, and that's a separate question, but the extent that you can actually identify where people are in terms of their value of their health is actually a first step.
But in this case, what the person really wants is to not have a pill that makes them feel bad and to not have hypertension that's going to kill them down the road. It's just that in a trade-off, they hierarchize one over the other. It's not that they love hypertension, it's that they don't want to have the side effect of being treated for it. So they don't like hypertension, they don't want to take the pill, they don't want to have a stroke, they don't want to change their life. That means that I share their same values. I just don't have to take the pill.
What if they don't understand the physical implications of hypertension even means? Then how can you consider it a value? You know, and I think, I mean, so you need to then take into their own health literacy into effect, and I think people's values would be affected by their knowledge and understanding of
those different health states and really understanding them. Again, the addiction literature is where it's really plays out very, very explicitly. in terms of people's value of health. Economists have looked very much at this value of different health states and trying to quantify different health states in terms of a hierarchy. Have been very, fairly successful. I mean, some of the approaches that are used, Standard Gamble and time trade-off and things, do get some distinction among different health states for people. Other thoughts or questions?
Thank you so much.
Yes,
this was great.
Thank you.
So please don't leave. Just walk right down the hall because the food is arrived and it's really great food. So please come and network and thank you so much.
Thank you. Grab this.
Thank you for
button.
Your question.
No, it's a great talk. I never am good at this thing. We use this all the time as our taping. The heck.